Welcome to this RCGP podcast on heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. I'm Dr. Emma Nash, GP and e-learning fellow at the RCGP. Today I'll be talking to Dr. Nicholas Jones, a GP cardiologist, academic GP, and Wellcome Trust doctoral research fellow at the University of Oxford. Thanks for joining us today, Nick.
Thanks, Emma. It's great to be here.
So let's start by looking at how the categorisation of heart failure has changed and what heart failure with preserved ejection fraction actually is.
So there used to be this categorisation based on the left ventricular systolic function, and it was thought to be either systolic or diastolic types of heart failure. So systolic heart failure, where there was impairment of the left ventricular systolic function, and diastolic being this sort of more diastolic, more of a sort of filling type problem with the heart failure. But what people realized is that perhaps there's a wider range of types of heart failure that might fall under the category of what's now considered heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, rather than just diastolic impairment itself. And this really came from randomized trials. So there was a big trial called the CHARM study, and this targeted treatments at people with a low left ventricular ejection fraction, and then considered other people with heart failure as having what they termed heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. But I think really what's important to take away is that this HEF-PEF, as it's called, categorization, is probably quite a heterogeneous group of people. So you might have people with diastolic impairment, but there's also other features that might be important, such as a very enlarged left atrium or other measures of filling problems that are categorized into that HEF-PEF family. So now the diagnosis of HEF-PEF takes into account a few different parameters. So first, you need to have symptoms of heart failure. So that might be signs of fluid overload or symptoms of fluid overload, might be breathlessness with exertion, might be fatigue. You also should really have biomarkers, so a raised NT-proBNP, and then some other changes on an echocardiogram or other types of cardiac imaging supportive of a diagnosis of HEF-PEF. But that might not be just diastolic impairment. There can be other parameters that might be changed there. I think it's also important to recognize that it can be quite a challenging diagnosis. So for example, atrial fibrillation is very common in people with HEF-PEF, but interpreting an echocardiogram of someone while they're in atrial fibrillation, it's very difficult. You can't really assess diastolic function there. And so you get into this problem with categorization, and that can have problems, therefore sort of leading into accurately diagnosing people with HEF-PEF. However, it is really important to try and diagnose and also to try and differentiate from that group of people who have heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. And one of the key differences here is that the evidence base for medicines having a prognostic improvement really come from those with HEF-REF, or reduced ejection fraction. So that's things like beta blockers, ACE inhibitors, MRAs, so the mineralocorticoid receptors, antagonists, things like spironolactone or eplerenone. All those really have an evidence base for helping people with heart failure and reduced ejection fraction, although that may be changing and there's some exciting new evidence for people with HEF-PEF in terms of treatment.
Great. Okay. So yes, it does sound quite complicated, doesn't it? And, you know, in terms of distinguishing between the two, and obviously it's very important too to be able to distinguish between the two. So what is the role of the GP in diagnosing HEF-PEF?
I think that these people are going to come to us in primary care, and as we're familiar with, it's, you know, with undifferentiated symptoms, sometimes things that might be confused either with just sort of simple aging, a slowing down or a gradual increasing breathlessness that people might think is just part of a normal aging process. Or they may commonly have other comorbid conditions such as ischemic heart disease or atrial fibrillation, COPD, that might present a confounding reason for them to be breathless. So I think a really important part of our role in general practice is considering heart failure in general as a possible diagnosis in these people, and obviously risk stratifying based on their past medical history. So we know that people who have a past history of hypertension, say, or atrial fibrillation, these people are more likely to develop HEF-PEF. So thinking about those risk factors, thinking about symptom presentation with breathlessness or edema or fatigue, and then trying to arrange appropriate investigations, particularly with an NT-proBNP test, guiding our future assessment from there. So if you've got someone with a raised NT-proBNP level, and in the UK, NICE suggests a cutoff of 400 for that, then we should be referring those patients on for further investigation in secondary care, usually with an echocardiogram to establish whether they do have heart failure, and also to categorize that based on whether it's heart failure with reduced or preserved ejection fraction. And that's where our cardiology colleagues will be, you know, hopefully very skilled in terms of making that diagnosis for us. NT-proBNP is helpful both as a diagnostic marker and also as a prognostic marker. So people with an NT-proBNP level over 2000 have a poorer prognosis and should be referred more urgently, ideally to be seen within a two-week timeframe, although I suspect across the UK, very few places are managing to achieve that aim that NICE is setting out.
You touched on this a little bit briefly about the treatment. So how is it treated? You said about, you know, the treatment between reduced ejection fraction and preserved ejection fraction being different. So in terms of HFpEF, what can we expect, including changes in licensing and data publication for the treatment of HFpEF?
So one of the key elements of treatment for heart failure in general has been around the role of diuretics for symptomatic management. And this is absolutely true for people with HFpEF as well as HFrEF. So thinking about using our loop diuretics like furosemide or bumetanide, also perhaps considering either the role of eplerenone or spironolactone as an alternative to a loop diuretic, or even in addition if it's you're not achieving that sort of adequate diuretic effect with a loop diuretic alone. Other things that might be helpful for people with HFpEF include rehabilitation or exercise programs. Obesity is common in people with HFpEF, so trying to encourage people to lose weight can also improve their symptom score and quality of life as well. However, traditionally, the difficulty has been, as I mentioned, that none of the drugs that have a prognostic benefit, i.e. they improve survival in people with heart failure and reduced ejection fraction, had been shown to confer that same survival benefit in people with HFpEF. So this is those drugs like ACE inhibitors, beta blockers, or the MRAs like spironolactone or eplerenone. What's really exciting and encouraging, though, is that there is evidence for the SGLT2 inhibitors now that they do seem to offer this prognostic benefit even in people with HFpEF. So originally, this was shown in the EMPEROR Preserved study that there seems to be a definite benefit for people with what's called heart failure with mid-range ejection fraction or mildly reduced ejection fraction. So this is a bit of a gray area. Heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, traditionally thought of where the systolic, the left ventricular ejection fraction is 50% or greater, reduced ejection fraction 40% or below, and in between is this sort of mid-range. So first of all, EMPEROR Preserved looked at empagliflozin and found some benefit for those with heart failure with mid-range ejection fraction. More recently, there's been the DELIVER study, which looked at dapagliflozin. And this showed that across the range of left ventricular ejection fractions, there was a survival benefit and also a reduction in heart failure hospitalization with dapagliflozin. So this is really, really encouraging. There's also been a pooled analysis now across these two studies showing that across ejection fractions, so including people with HFpEF, there does seem to be a survival benefit. Now, at the time of making this podcast, SGLT2 inhibitors aren't yet licensed for people with HFpEF in the UK, but I think we're quite likely to see a change in licensing sometime in the coming months. They are now licensed SGLT2 inhibitors in the USA across the range of ejection fractions. The other thing that's sort of interesting is there's another group of medicine called ARNI medications. So this is predominantly the combination drug called sacrobutel valsartan, or people might know it as Entresto. There was a randomized trial called the Paragon HS study, and this showed that there's probably some survival benefit with sacrobutel valsartan also across the range of left ventricular ejection fractions. And again, in the US, this has led to licensing for ARNI medications, Entresto's, for people irrespective of the left ventricular ejection fraction and not just those with HFrEF. So I think what we're seeing now is a move to medicines having a prognostic benefit with heart failure and preserved ejection fraction, namely the SGLT2 inhibitors and these ARNI medications. And I think we're quite likely to see changing in licenses in the coming months in the UK.
Great, thanks, Nick. It's good to hear that there are potential opportunities for treatment of this condition. And obviously, these patients over the longer term are going to be cared for in primary care. And you've mentioned some of the drugs that we're familiar with, although perhaps not being used in the same way that we are used to using them. What's the role of primary care in the kind of longer term treatment? You know, what should we be looking to do, or further referrals or monitoring? I'd be interested to know what your thoughts are on what we should be doing in primary care.
Yeah, I think our role is very important for these patients. I think that they very often have been sort of discharged back from secondary care services to primary care because there hasn't been so much that our cardiology colleagues are able to offer them. And so hasn't been so much sort of point, if you like, in terms of offering them routine follow-up in a cardiology clinic. Similarly, I know that there are heart failure nursing services around the UK which will offer input for patients with heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, but not for those with heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. And so the sort of emphasis is for us to oversee their treatment going forward. So it's an important question. What can we do for them? Well, I think one thing is to think about managing their comorbid disease. So we know uncontrolled hypertension can worsen left atrial enlargement, for example. So I think emphasizing the importance of management of cardiovascular comorbidities is really important. That goes for atrial fibrillation as well. Atrial fibrillation often can leave people feeling quite breathless and fatigued as well. So thinking about whether those patients with AF can either benefit from improved rate control or even whether they might need a rhythm control approach to their AF management is important to think about. We've mentioned a little bit about some of the sort of more holistic approaches to management that we might take in terms of promoting physical exercise, weight loss to improve quality of life and exercise capacity. So I think those things are really important. Can we refer patients to weight management services, for example, to support them in their goals to lose weight? Smoking cessation, obviously important in patients where they have breathlessness or comorbid respiratory disease, is very important to think about. I think the other thing that's really important to sort of, you know, conceptualize is that symptom burden with heart failure in general is never static. So people tend to go through periods where symptoms might be quite well controlled, but they're at risk of decompensating and develop fluid buildup and breathlessness. And so I think we need to educate our patients that that might happen and encourage them to contact us as their primary care clinicians if they do start to experience fluid buildup or breathlessness, and then use that as an opportunity to try and review their treatment and think about up-titrating diuretic doses, trying to maintain fluid balance. I think the other thing, you know, that we know is obviously a lot of these patients might have been discharged back to primary care, but we're talking about some of these new medications being licensed in the future. So I think it might be something as a quality improvement project to think about going forward, that if we have a new licensing for SGLT2 inhibitors or these ARNI medications, that we think about running searches to identify patients with HFpEF in our practice and think about referring those patients back or even starting an SGLT2 inhibitor if we feel confident to do so once they are licensed in primary care, particularly perhaps in patients who also have diseases like diabetes where there's already another licensing indication for them. And I think one thing that's really important there that I know we're not really doing so well at the moment is coding patients with heart failure based on their ejection fraction, and that will really help us identify those patients better. So I think we do have, you know, a really important key role in the management of these patients. I think things are changing going forward, and that might be a challenge because with inertia, if we don't sort of proactively try and pick up on these patients, then they may miss out on some of the opportunities for these medications that are coming out.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Nick. That's really helpful. There's obviously going to be a lot of scope for further GP input as time goes on and licenses change and, you know, we learn more about the condition. So thank you so much for your input on that. When you're managing these patients with fluid overload, obviously with the cardiovascular disease that quite often goes with it, renal function is usually not tip top. How do you balance this maintaining renal function over diuretics and try and reduce this fluid overload?
I think that is always a very difficult situation, and the worse the renal function, the more jumpy we can get. You know, I've certainly been in that situation myself. I think for patients, they will feel better if we are able to adequately offload them. And I think that sometimes that means that we have to be quite brave in you know, being willing to up titrate doses of diuretic medication, even in the face of impaired renal function. I think there are obviously times when we need to think about whether we, you know, get secondary care involvement or whether we need to stop and reflect on what we're doing is the right thing. So, for example, if we're trying to up titrate the dose of diuretics and there's significant electrolyte imbalance, so very low sodium levels or high potassium levels are developing. But I think if there is some decline in renal function, then we probably need to keep pushing to increase the doses of our diuretics and help offload those patients. Once you've done that and you're able to titrate back down on the diuretic doses, it tends to be that the renal function will recover. You know, I think stepping back from that and taking a look about where that patient is up to, though, I think once you get in that situation where someone has deteriorating renal function, you're having difficulty offloading them with normal doses of diuretics, you know, their renal function is significantly worsening with high doses of diuretics that you might be needing, that's not a very good prognostic sign. And I think whilst it's important to make sure that we do try and treat them symptomatically, I think it also should be a time when we're thinking about advanced care plans and about ceilings of care and trying to have some of those difficult discussions that we are very well placed to do in primary care about sort of what is a patient's priorities and what's their, you know, where would they like to have their sort of end of life care? How far do they want to go with treatment? And you know, making sure that those things are documented, making sure that we've got a DNAR form completed if necessary. So, you know, I think treating the symptoms is really, really important. It's horrible to be fluid overloaded. And I think, you know, that should be the goal of care, but it is a difficult situation and not being afraid to ask for secondary care input if it's a challenge.
Brilliant. Thanks, Nick. I think that's probably all we've got time for today. So I'd like to say a big thank you to Dr. Nick Jones for joining us to discuss heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. Thank you for listening. And if you enjoyed this RCGP podcast, then please have a look at the e-learning website to find others on a variety of subjects. Goodbye.